Earth Matters, a weekly segment of environmental news.
Our demands may be radical, but the demands of the Earth are truly non-negotiable. Corporations and biology do not mix.
The 23rd Annual Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, otherwise known as ELAW, concluded a few days ago at the University of Oregon in Eugene. ELAW is the Woodstock of environmental gatherings. More than 4,000 lawyers, scientists, students, muckraking journalists, ex-corporate whistleblowers, and the most grassrootsy of earth-loving activists from across this planet gathered to share their energy, innovation, and inspiration on topics covered by some 150 panels, keynote speeches, films, and workshops. But one issue underlay them all, and it is climate change. For Flashpoints, I spoke with two brilliant, passionate people, two heroes of the public interest world, who are fighting for real change of the most radical kind, climate justice. I'm speaking with Peter Roderick from the Climate Justice Program in the UK. Peter, thanks for talking with us on Flashpoints.
Okay, my pleasure.
Can you talk about the organization that you work with in the UK?
Yeah, the Climate Justice Program is an international collaboration of lawyers, campaigners, supported by scientists who believe that it's important that the law plays a role in addressing climate change.
Can you tell me what your presentation was about today?
Okay. I presented the development of the international consensus on the science, showed how it had evolved. Then I showed how that evidence had been accepted and endorsed by five U.S. scientific bodies, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the American Meteorological Society, and such like. And then I showed how that science had been completely contradicted by the Department of Justice.
Tell us, what's the type of evidence that you were talking about?
If you like, it's the basic science of climate change, that human beings are increasing the temperature around the world, wherever we are.
Can you talk about some of the specific examples of effects of global warming?
Well, one of the most visible effects, perhaps the canary in the coal mine, if you like, are the melting of snow and ice and glaciers and the bleaching of coral reefs. Both these are very close to temperature increases. For example, we know that the Arctic is melting significantly, and that affects the Inuit and people who live in the Arctic. We know that glaciers have retreated in the Himalayas, where glacial lakes at risk of outburst flood have formed.
And what happens when they burst?
Well, it's just catastrophe. You have this huge volume of water and debris just crashing down valleys. It's very urgent that something is done about that, that we don't wait for a disaster to happen. And it's really great to be doing this interview, because in recording this, you know, we can make it clear that it was known now that these lakes could burst and that something could be done about it.
Can you talk about the human rights angle in terms of leverage for litigation?
Well, I personally think that the human rights environment connection broad generally is a very important one. At the end of the day, you know, it's not some sort of irrelevant issue about protection of the environment. It's very important because human beings are affected, and it's a way of reminding us that we live in a world that is absolutely interconnected to nature. And so I'm a big supporter of how that jurisprudence has developed. Not, I should say, that in any way it's enough. There are legitimate criticisms that it's quite anthropocentric. But at the end of the day, we're talking here about legal tools and what's legally possible. And of course, the law is massively imperfect. But as lawyers and public interest lawyers, it's important for us to do what we can with the tools that we've got and to develop those, and not to be limited by the ignorance, the self-interest, the greed of corporations and of politicians.
Is it difficult to apply law from a global problem to a local level? Is there a way that the science can translate? Is that something that global climate change litigation is working on?
Yes, absolutely. I think this will be the one of the key moments when the world realizes that it's a global village that we live in. And the idea, 100 years ago, the idea that activities in one part of the world could affect the other part of the world would have been, we just wouldn't have got our heads around that. Now we've got so much knowledge and have, developed at such an amazing rate that we now know that this is actually what happens. And so for us as public interest lawyers, it's really important that we try to apply the tools and develop the legal tools that we have to reflect reality.
What do you think is the most effective tool for creating a global climate law system? You talk about the law. Are you talking about, you know, laws of different states, right? How can we transcend that upwards?
Yeah. In an ideal world, you'd have the governments of the world sitting around the table and saying, we've really got to do something about this. They've started to try to do that in the Kyoto Protocol. As we all know, it's not been sufficient. Some states don't want to play ball. And it remains, it seems to me, essential that we have unanimous international agreements that have significant cuts in greenhouse gas emissions.
Can you talk more about your motivation and what your real hopes are for this work that you do?
Motivation is a big word, and I again, etymologically, it's about emotion. You know, it's the same root of the word. So I think in the end, it has to come from the heart. It has to come from caring. It has to come from that part of the human being. And to work for me, it's really important to connect the emotional base with the legal constructs, to not seeing them as opposed to one another. Actually, there's a lovely statement from John Steinbeck in Travels with Charlie, where he said, man has to have feelings and then words before he can come close to thought. And that's a beautiful capturing for me of how we are as human beings.
Peter Roderick, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I also spoke with Prakash Mani Sharma, who is with the public interest group ProPublic in Nepal.
I'm speaking with Prakash Mani Sharma about global warming, climate change. Can you talk about the work that you do in Nepal?
Sure. Yeah. The problem is created somewhere else. It impacts globally. And in this case, Nepal. We are talking about the glacier retreat impact on the Himalayas. We are not contributing significantly in the global warming, but the people of Nepal, who even don't know what is global warming, what is temperature rise, how it works, they don't know. They are ignorant. They are just living, you know, for their survival. And they are also unaware that next day might be a glacier lake will burst, and their, you know, children, themselves, their property, everything gone. Because of the global warming, temperature are rising, and that has impact in the high altitude, and those are Himalayas. That is creating new glacier lakes. There is a risk that those glaciers cannot sustain that much of water, so they are going to burst. In 1985, it happened already.
The lake burst?
Yeah, lake burst. People lost their life, they lost their cattle. Two Sherpas from that community climbed Mount Everest in the shortest time, 8 hours.
Eight hours?
8 hours and 15 minutes.
There's no ice up there now?
They said that it's not like earlier. And we had recently 50th anniversary of the Mount Everest climb. And Edmund Hillary was there. He said that, look, there is no ice. There is no snows in the mountains. So it is also one of reason that they can climb easily. So we are losing natural beauty. This is a World Heritage Site, and it's a property of the whole population of the world, and not only for today's world, but for the tomorrow's world. Because if our ancestors have done same thing, you know, with our nature, we would have never seen these beauties. Because of the greenhouse gas emission that is happening just for our comfort. And I'm sorry to say that, you know, in the world, only 4% population lives in America. And they are contributing 25%. Can you believe that? And it's not that we cannot live what we are doing now. It's our responsibility. We have to think, we have to change our behavior, and we have to sacrifice.
What do you think is the most important way to get that information across to people, or to awaken that awareness in people?
I think it's media. Media has to take responsibility. I'm sorry, but I have to say that we are working, you know, day and night to change the, you know, bring people to be eco-centric, you know. I'm happy that you are asking about these questions. I don't see, if you go and read the paper, there is all bullshit political news. And they are after all these political, you know, power mongers. So I think that media has a very bigger role to play, and that is their social responsibility. Otherwise, you know, if we lost our nature, if we lost our biodiversity, if we lost our mother nature, we are going to go nowhere. Where we are going?
Can you talk more about a biocentric point of view?
Exactly. We are also a species in this Mother Earth. We are not the only. There are thousands, millions Mother Earth has created. So I think we have to find out our role. And I think, you know, we have become very selfish, very greedy. And we are not, you know, we are not honoring, we are not respecting Mother Earth rules. So we think that because we have got conscience, we say we are civilized, but I think we are not. And we are doing all mess. And there is, I found, leaflet which said that, oh my God, voluntary human extinction. Okay, we should not be here. We should not be here, then things will be happen. But I think that is extreme. We can do, if we say that we are civilized, we have conscience, we are animal, but we are a rational animal. That's why we are focusing on ourselves, our own interest, our pleasure. You know, we don't care about other things. We don't care about other species. That is, we are not focusing on the ecocentric. We are centering ourselves for our, you know, human being self. So in that context, I think we have to have balance. We have to respect nature. If we don't do, we are gone. And it is time to, you know, act in ecocentric way. Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks.
For more information about eLaw, you can go to pielc.org on the web. Reporting for Flashpoints in Berkeley, this is Amanda Bellerby.